One of the formative experiences in my life happened in Honduras many years ago. I was at a pastor's meeting. And I was there, and there were a lot of pastors, and they were praising. How many of you have ever been to Honduras? They get at it on the praise side, all right? And this is one of those places. They were just getting at it, all right? And I was a little uncomfortable. I've chilled a bit in my old age, but I was a little uncomfortable. They were flying about a bit, if you know what I mean. And so I was just kind of flying about a bit. I was a little uncomfortable. And all of a sudden, this woman, they said, was a prophetess. They said, there's two prophetesses who are going to come. I thought, well, that's cool, I guess. And so they came, and the first prophetess had a big jar full of olive oil. And she was just, got her hand in the jar, and she was just slinging it all over the place. She's just slinging it. So I'm sitting there, and the prophetess comes by, and she throws all this olive oil, and it's all over my shirt and all over my pants. And I'm thinking, terrible. Terrible. Horrible. And then the next one came, and it made me appreciate the first one, because the next one had a big jar of honey, and she was walking up to the pastors, and she stuck her hand in the honey and got a whole handful and was sticking it on people's mouths. Now, I'm sure that meant something. What it meant to me was I didn't want to do it, and so I'm sitting there thinking, really kind of having a discussion with the Lord. Just kind of saying, Lord, this is terrible. I've already ruined my shirt and my pants. And you know how I am about that, Lord. And now the honey woman is coming. And I think I'm going to go try to find a restroom in another village. And God just spoke something to my heart. I know you're uncomfortable, but shut up and get anointed. There are times in our lives we just need to shut up and let the Holy Spirit do his work in us. There are times in our life we need to not think it through all the time, but just shut up and get anointed. So when the Spirit's rolling through, guys, let's not be uptight. Let's not worry about our shirt. You can always buy another shirt, but the Holy Spirit doesn't always roll through. Sometimes you just gotta let God do what God does. And if it requires us loosening up a little, let's pray it loosens us up in all the places we most need loosening. It was 1990. For years when I've told this story, I changed the guy's name, but his name was James. His name was James. He was in his late 40s. He'd been raised by a domineering mother, and his older brother had shot one of his eyes out with a BB gun when they were boys. He had a decent job, a bad marriage, a slow tongue, and a burning desire. James wanted to learn how to read. I was his pastor during my seminary years in Georgia, and one day James asked me to teach him to read. It seemed daunting. For several months, we spent time every single Sunday afternoon reading the Psalms. And week after week, James would stumble over the letters. He would let the words slip away. He would make pronunciations that just mystified me. And he never seemed to get it at all. One Sunday afternoon, he was reading this psalm, the 24th psalm, in my office. Things are going about like usual. And then he hit the 8th verse. And the Spirit of the Lord came down. And oil seemed to fly about. Maybe an angel anointed his lips. And for the first time, he read a sentence. And it seemed to surprise him. When he said, "Who is the King of Glory?" In a thick southern drawl. When he said that, something just happened. His heart was strangely warmed, and he started to cry. The Lord, strong and mighty. The Lord, mighty in battle. And now he was reading fluently, screaming in my office. The Lord of hosts, he is the King of Glory. And then it was done. He looked at me and went like this. He closed the Bible, and we never read again. He got it. He saw the light of the glory of the Lord with his own eyes. When I was a kid, I grew up Southern Baptist. And of all the great ironies, we sometimes sang a Hank Williams song. He never appeared to me to be a Southern Baptist. He wrote a hymn called I Saw the Light. Church, I wonder sometimes, are we seeing the light? Or like Hank Williams, are we just singing about a light we really don't see at all? Our God is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Are we seeing the light? Our God is a mighty warrior. Are we seeing the light? We don't have to be afraid because God is with us. Are we seeing the light? God wants to be in relationship with us. Are we seeing the light? James saw it. Not for long, I might add. But on an incredible Sunday afternoon, in my musty, moldy office in that little church in Georgia, James saw the light. Let's contextualize the Psalms as we enter a new series. Number one, if you're taking notes, now's when you do it. There's a place inside your bulletin to do so. Number one, we should think of the Psalms as a songbook. They are songs. Number two, the Psalms were probably written over hundreds of years in various historical contexts by many authors. So you guys remember hymnals? I think there's probably some under your seats. Hymnals were a collection of psalms, but they were written over hundreds of years by various authors. The Psalms are the same way. Number three, the Psalms were collected, edited, and compiled. At some point, kind of like the Brothers Grimm did with fairy tales in Germany and in Europe, at some point somebody got together and said, let's pull all these psalms together, let's bind them up, let's make a book. Number four, it's impossible to place most of the Psalms in an historical context. A few you can, but for the most part, you just can't. Number five, it's impossible to verify authorship. However, some of the Psalms are attributed to somebody, and I don't see any real reason to doubt that, but it's impossible to verify authorship. Number six, the tunes to the songs have been lost, all right? They've just been lost. And then number seven, the Psalms have served as a devotional guide for centuries. Those of you that kind of keep up with my dad, Fred Bishop, he has had a discipline for the last, boy, I'm guessing 60 years? He reads a psalm every single day. It's a part of his discipline. I bet you my dad has never missed reading a psalm. That's just what he does. So the Psalms, for a lot of people, have become devotional guides. What's cool about the Psalms is you kind of get this, you get this sweep of emotions. At times, the psalmist is devastated and absolutely caught up in the throes of despair. And at other times, he's just rejoicing. And what's weird is it can be like one sentence apart. We can relate to that, can't we? We can relate to that. There's a certain manicness to the Psalms. And within this wild stream of emotions, we can usually posit somewhere that relates to where we are. Now let me tell you a little bit about the 24th Psalm specifically. Number one, it's one of the 73 Psalms directly attributed to King David. All right? Number two, no specific event or historical context is associated with the psalm. So it sort of just hangs out there. Three, it's probably a general song celebrating the kingship of God. So it kind of becomes a how great thou art kind of piece. It's not given in reference to something specific. It just recounts the glory of God. Number four, in this psalm, the Creator establishes his rule over his creation. I want to be very clear. We do not believe in what is called a watchmaker God. The watchmaker God theory says essentially that God made the watch and then kind of wound it, and then God is sort of gone. He's not paying much attention to the world anymore. We do not believe in that. We believe that God created the world, but we believe that God is active in the affairs of humanity. We believe in an active God, a present God, Emmanuel, a name called, that's attributed to Jesus that rolls back from Isaiah, means God with us. Not God over us, God with us. God's in it. Whatever you're going through today, God's in it. He's not up there saying, well, I told you so. You got other people to do that. God is in it with you. Number five, people accept God's rule by keeping God's laws. And this is the thing that I think is lost in modern theology. People want to say, well, it's all about what you believe. But the Bible's real clear. If what we believe does not influence what we do, then what we believe really doesn't matter all that much. People accept God's rule by keeping his laws. And then number six, the warrior nature of God maintains his covenant. God's kind of out there getting it. He's getting at it a little bit. God's turning it up a little bit. God is referred to as a mighty warrior. A lot of people today think God is sort of a really nice, open-minded person that's just kind of going with the flow of everything. That is not the God described in the Old Testament. The Old Testament, God does not go with our flow. So let's get at this. This psalm kind of sits and would have set in a time in Israel's history called the exile. It would have been a big part of what they were doing. It would not be difficult to argue that the exile to Babylon under the rule of Nebuchadnezzar around 600 BC literally saved Judaism. It was one of those times that could have broken Judaism, but it didn't break them, it actually made them. You see, God does that quite a bit. In all of our lives, there will be things that could break us, but for whatever reason, they end up making us. You see, Israel had drifted away from God. They were worshiping other gods. They had rejected God's commandments. They were losing their identity as God's chosen people. All that was gone. They were about to lose everything they were, and suddenly, they are taken over by Nebuchadnezzar, and he grabs a big hunk of the intelligentsia, and he moves them across their world. And in doing that, he kind of saves Judaism, because once in Babylon, they revive the faith. Sometimes the difficult things that happen in our lives save us, because it throws us back to God. It throws us back to God. That's what happens here. When God made a promise to Abraham that he would someday become the father of a great nation, a people were chosen from the people of the world. And they were a distinct people that we call the Jewish people. And from them, God promised he would one day send a savior to the world, who we believe is Jesus Christ. However, getting salvation history from Abraham to Jesus was a daunting mess. And if you don't believe me, read the Old Testament. It was just daunting. God's people were to be distinct. And because of that, assimilation with the surrounding people groups was always their temptation. But it was, when they obeyed God, it was always the reason they were persecuted. Everywhere Israel was, people said, why can't they just fit in? Why do they have to dress different? Why do they have to eat different? Why can't they eat barbecue pork like the rest of us? Why do they have to live in their own communities? Why do they have to do that? As long as they did that, they were being faithful to God, and they got persecuted. When they didn't, they were not being faithful to God, and they weren't getting persecuted. Sometimes it's tough to be the chosen people of God. Once enslaved in Egypt, they had been led out of bondage by Moses. And to Moses, Yahweh gave the people the terms of their uniqueness, the Ten Commandments. So if you're ever thinking theologically, what's the role of the Ten Commandments? They are the terms of our uniqueness. These ten directives were the basis of just how Jewish people were to be different than people in general. The people of the world are that, and you are to be this. They worship many gods. You are to worship one God. They steal from one another. You will respect private property. They have no sexual ethic. You will not commit adultery. You get the idea. It's how they were different. When Nebuchadnezzar took over his world and vanquished Jerusalem, it literally seemed that the process that had been made in salvation history was eradicated in chutes and ladders fashion. This is the ancient world. Anybody remember from Western Civ what this is called? This is called the Fertile Crescent, right? The Fertile Crescent. And this is sort of the birthplace of civilization. Everything from soap to beer was invented in the Fertile Crescent, all right? Now, I want to remind you here of where the story of Abraham begins. Bam, He goes with his father, Terah. They are business people, and they begin a journey up around the Fertile Crescent. They go up to Haran. Somewhere in here, God speaks to Abraham. Terah dies. Abram becomes Abraham. They literally head through this area, the land of promise, but they do not stop in the promised land. They literally head down into the deserts here, and then they head back up, and then they're enslaved, and then they head back up. So this is kind of that area. So this is what had happened in salvation history. But when you look at the exile, Jerusalem is here, Samaria is here. In the exile, Nebuchadnezzar took God's chosen people back to where they started. Literally. It was like, go to jail. Go directly to jail. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Sure, you've been following me more or less for 1,000 years. You are right back where you started. It had to be devastating. Devastating. But we Christians know something better than anyone. Death must precede resurrection. In Babylon, Israel pulled it together. They rediscovered their faith. They fired off some great Bible stories like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They wrote some incredible literature. And like their ancestors enslaved in Egypt centuries early, they dreamed of a day that they would return to Israel. The Babylonian religion did not seem to tempt or entrap the exiles in any kind of huge way. In fact, it sort of seemed to help. Babylonian religion is very deeply rooted in the polytheistic Sumerian culture of Mesopotamia. And under Nebuchadnezzar and company, Babylonian religion was directly tied to loyalty to the empire. It's a lot like emperor worship was in Paul's time. So Nebuchadnezzar makes a big statue of himself. The big idea isn't that Nebuchadnezzar is a god. The big idea is if you don't bow to the statue, you're not loyal to the country. It becomes a civic issue every bit as much as a religious one. So it's kind of interesting here that loyalty to the king becomes tied up in their faith system. But the Jews cannot buy in. They just can't. They can't get there. There is one God, and it's not Nebuchadnezzar. Not only that, we're not allowed to worship idols of any kind, and they like have the world's largest one. The Babylonians actually helped develop some of the Jewish ideology. And let me give you an example of a case in point. The Babylonians were polytheistic, which means they believe in many gods. They celebrated a different main god on every day of the week. Is everybody with me there? They celebrated a different god on every single day of the week. That is a part of their religious discipline, or as disciplined as polytheists get. One of the Jewish practices developed in Babylon was a variation of that associated a psalm with every day of the week. And guess what the Sunday psalm was? The day after the Sabbath. Boom! Psalm 24. What we've just read right here. Coming off of the Sabbath, this psalm refocused the hearts of the people on the nature of their warrior, deliverer, king, Yahweh. Yahweh is simply God in Hebrew. So let's explore the 24th Psalm. Verse 1, the earth and those in it are the Lord's. You are God's. You are God's very own. This is a statement of fact. You are God's creation. The earth is the Lord's. It doesn't really matter if you like it or not. But your disposition toward the reality, frankly, is completely irrelevant. God created and ordered the cosmos. God created and ordered the earth. God created human beings. God sets the rules for human beings. He made it. You and me are in it. God makes the rules. We don't. That's why, if you disagree with the Bible's teachings, who cares? Seriously, who cares? You know, it's like if I disagree with gravity. I can disagree with gravity. I can write papers on disagreeing with gravity. I could start a gravity sucks club. You know, I mean, I could do anything you want to do there. But the bottom line is, whether I believe in gravity or not, when I jump up, I'm going to come down. Because what I believe to be true about gravity, and 50 cents buys me a Coke. I think they're a dollar and a quarter now. It doesn't matter if I believe it or not. It doesn't matter if I believe it to be true or not. It just is. You are God's creation. You live in a world that God made. God makes the rules. Doesn't matter if you like it or not. Doesn't matter if you believe it or not. It just doesn't. Verse 3, who shall ascend the hill of the Lord? If this were a physical question about who can climb the hill of the Lord, the answer would be the one who walks well and is in good physical condition. But we're talking about a spiritual destination, not a physical one. You see, during the exile, ascending to Jerusalem became more and more an idea and less a hike. Remember, Jerusalem, as the Jews knew it before the exile, was gone. Solomon's temple was gone. Nebuchadnezzar razed it and he chunked it into the Kidron Valley. The holy city, Jerusalem, gone. 587 BC, Nebuchadnezzar sends his general in and they wipe out the city. Jerusalem and the temple are really no longer a place. They're a metaphor. They're a metaphor for home on one hand and a plane upon which humanity can walk with her creator on the other. Isn't that really what worship is? Finding a plane upon which we as human beings can walk with God? When we're singing sometimes, have you ever just get swept up in it? And you're suddenly no longer self-conscious, a la oil on your shirt? But you become conscious of nothing other than the presence of God? Have you ever gotten into that zone? If you ever have, you'll want to go back. Jerusalem's an idea. God's holy mountain is a plain. In a sense, because the city of Jerusalem and the temple were now essentially nowhere, they suddenly existed everywhere. Who among creation is pleasing to the Creator? Which of God's works bring him particular joy? How do we please God? If we can go to this mountain anytime, if we can ascend the mountain of the Lord anytime, if the invitation is always there, no matter where we are, who gets to go? That becomes the question. So, four things the psalm tells us. Who is qualified to interface with God? Who gets to walk in the God zone? All right? That was for you, Michael. Boom. All right. Who gets to walk in the God zone? Here we go. Number one, those with clean hands. Those whose actions are above reproach. Those who choose to do the right thing regardless of the cost. Clean hands in the Bible does not refer to what we believe. It refers to what we do. It refers to what we do. You want to walk, you want to ascend the temple to the temple of the Lord, you want to walk on God's plane, you got to go up there with clean hands. Number two, those with pure hearts. Those who operate with love in their hearts and pure motives. Pure hearts, biblically, always refers to attitudes. Attitudes. I don't mean this in a bad way, but some of the most moral, religious people I've ever met in my life were some of the meanest. They had clean hands in the terms of what they did. They, you know, but their hearts weren't good. He said bad hearts. Number three, those who do not lift up their souls to vanity. Like not wanting anointing oil on your shirt. There are some tricky translation issues here, but it's really, in Hebrew, it's about knowing the difference between what's worth giving your life to and what's not. And what the Hebrew is really indicating is how you look really doesn't matter. How you dress really doesn't matter. In fact, if you give those things, if you give yourself to those things, you're giving yourself to vanity. When we do not trade the holy for the profane, and when we prioritize things of no worth over things of, when we do not trade the holy for the profane, and when we prioritize things of no worth over things of great worth, we find ourselves in a very, very different kind of position. So what does it mean to not lift up our souls to vanity? It means we do not elevate things that God doesn't elevate. We don't call important things God says aren't important. But our society has this whole idea of what's important. How you look, how you think, all of those kind of things. And God says, you know what? That's really not it. You got to have clean hands. You got to have a pure heart. And you got to not lift your soul up to vanity. And then number four, those who do not swear deceitfully. Here it is again. God is once again concerned about the words that come out of our mouths. Those whose words are never used to mislead or misdirect or lead others astray or tear down what God has built up, those are the people that are pleasing to God. And I've known a lot of people in my life I honestly think have clean hands, and I think they have fairly pure hearts and their motives are pretty good, but they're gossips and they're busybodies and they do damage because they can't stay in their own lane. And I think that's why this four things were given. So people who do the right thing, people who do the right things for the wrong reasons, people who have the right priorities, and people who refuse to do harm with their mouth. Those are the people that get to ascend God's holy mountain. How's that? So we might ask, what kind of reward does God give those who successfully climb the mountain? What do you get when you climb it? What happens when you establish intimacy with God? Well, the psalm mentions two very specific things. Number one, verse 5, they will receive blessing. What is the blessing of seeking intimacy with God? It's intimacy with God. What is the reward of following God? God. The hymn writer got it right. And he walks with me, and he talks with me, and he tells me I am his own. If you're going to God because you want something from God, that's got to get old. You got any people that call themselves friends or family, but the only time they ever want you is when they want something? That's annoying. There's a word that defines that. It's called parasite. It's something that it takes and takes and takes but never gives. A dog may have a tick, but a dog doesn't think the tick's his best friend. So the psalmist says, if we ascend the mountains of the Lord, we will receive blessing. Blessing has to do with divine favor that God bestows upon those who please him. Who gets blessed? People with clean hearts, people with clean hands, pure hearts, who do not lift their souls to vanity, who do not speak negative things and deceitful things with their mouth. What do they receive? They receive blessing. God gives his divine favor to those who please him. And yet, I think there's this human element to blessing. We have to be blessable. I think a lot of people pray, God, bless me, bless me, bless me, but it never occurs to them. Nothing they're doing is blessable. Nothing they're doing is blessable. How many of you remember the Prayer of Jabez, the little book a few years back? Prayer of Jabez was this little book exegeting a very short prayer from an overlooked part of the Bible that became a New York Times bestseller. Literally, this is true. Literally, people bought the book, and they prayed the prayer every single day and waited for blessings to fall. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't understand the difference between a prayer and an incantation. Incantations are magic words that are designed to produce some kind of outcome. A prayer is the relational expression of covenant with God. We do not pray to manipulate God. It's not what prayer is about. Prayer is getting so attuned to God that we truly want His will and not our own. If you really seriously take a petition to the Lord, a lot of the times you walk out of there with that petition changed. God is not some kind of eschatological DJ, and you are not a person that makes requests. And if God doesn't answer it quickly enough, you slip him a 20 in the offering. It's not how it works. Blessing is offered at the initiative of God, but it is consummated by the obedience of mortals. Don't pray for God's blessing if you're not walking in God's favor and in God's commandments and in God's will. It's a waste of your time. God isn't going to bless your mess. He would be untrue to himself to do it. And then number two, not only do you get blessing if you get up, but you get vindicated. Remember I was talking about the 23rd Psalm? This comes right out of it. There's this how do you like me now element to the Psalms. And I know for a lot of you it doesn't seem very Christian, but you got to remember this is all before Christ anyway, right? So here we go. Vindication. Vindication is about truth redeeming the innocent, not punishment eluding the guilty. The Bible states that Satan is a liar and an accuser. When I was a kid, my mom used to say it all the time, Satan is a liar and the father of lies and there is no truth in him. I mean, my mom said it all the time. Satan is a liar and the father of lies and there is no truth in him. Sometimes mom would say it even when it was completely inappropriate. I'd say, Mom, what's for supper? And she'd go, Satan is a liar and the father of lies and there is no truth in him. I can't tell you how many times I heard that. Satan is a liar. He's an accuser. He's going to try to keep you from becoming what God's created you to be. And one way Satan does that is he throws your past at you. He throws your past at you. You see, many of you live your lives within constant earshot of Satan's accusations. Satan says stuff like this, you shouldn't join a connect group. You don't know enough about the Bible and you'll just look foolish. You can't teach a class. If you knew anything, you could live it. Who are you to share your faith? What makes you any better than anyone else? Who are you to volunteer at church? If they knew your past, they would kick you out. If the people at work knew you were at church, they'd fall over laughing. Who are you trying to fool? Has anybody ever heard voices like that? What the psalmist says, if we are pleasing to God, we'll be vindicated. And not only that, but the 23rd Psalm says we'll be vindicated in the presence of our enemies. God will line up all those people that are trying to bring us down, and he will make them watch while we are honored for following him. You say, I don't know how I feel about that. David felt great about it. Loved it. Loved it all day long. There's vindication. Verse 7, lift up your heads, ancient gates, and let the King of Glory enter. In 1929, some French archaeologists uncovered a forgotten Semitic language with accompanying literature in modern Syria. This really has proven to be invaluable because it helps us understand the context and the sources of the biblical texts written in this region, particularly the exile material. One such text denotes that the Ugaritic gods look down when they are being humiliated and they look up when they have reason to be hopeful or rejoice. We think there's a strong chance this psalm came from the exilic period. So in those days, in their culture, the idea is if you're being humbled, you look down, and if you're being exalted, you look up. If you're ashamed, you look down. But if you're expecting reward, you look up. David ends this passage with a call for the people to come to worship. Lift up your heads. Lift up your heads. During the early part of my ministry, I was pretty suspicious of any form of emotionalism in worship. I really was. I was just generally suspicious of it. And I remember one day a fellow pastor asked me a very pointed question. He said, if we can't tangibly feel the presence of an invisible God, how can we possibly know whether or not God is with us? And if God's presence can be felt, would not a human being have an emotional response to it? I thought, wow. So I began to study the great historical movements of God, and I quickly formed this conclusion. When God is around, people feel it. When God is around, people feel it. So I'm going to ask you, what keeps you from truly worshiping God? What is the reason you don't press into that next level? What's the reason your head isn't up? For years, for me, it was frankly my intellect. It was in my mind. I couldn't make peace with it in my mind. But I've got to tell you, if your intellect keeps you from truly having a relationship with God, how smart could you possibly be? Verse 8, who is the King of glory? I love this. Who is the King of glory? Who is the one I love the most? Who is the one who shines favor on my face? Who is the one who is righteous and holy? Who is the one whose love is everlasting? Who is the one that stays with me when everybody else turns away? Who is the one that pulls me out of the gutter when I have put myself into it? Who is the King of glory? The Lord. The Lord. I could just still hear James. The Lord! He's just screaming in my office. Mighty in battle. You know what the psalmist is saying? The Lord, in the last psalm, he said, the Lord is my shepherd. You know what he's saying in this one? The Lord is my hero. I grew up surrounded by all these gentle Jesus pictures. He always looked so pale. So soft. He looked like a guy who's mom was too domineering to let him date, and whose dad was too busy to toss a ball around. And then I realized all those people who painted those pictures of Jesus were really good artists, but they were pretty bad theologians. Jesus was a man's man. He had callous hands of a carpenter. He had a good eye for level. He had the smell of a man. He'd been around the fishing docks. He had the burned skin of a man who had no home. And he had the robustness of a Galilean. And the Galileans were a robust lot. You ought to read what the ancients have to say about the Galileans. They were hot-headed, tightly strung, and passionate people. They fished the waters and they worked in the villages of that time. And I've always wondered, you know, what was a Galilean like? And then I visited Galilee for the first time in 1997. You ought to see what I saw. This Jewish family was having a wedding. And they were dancing in the aftermath of the wedding. And there was this old dude, somewhere between 80 and 300. He's this old dude. He's dressed in traditional Jewish garb. And I watched him dance. Must have been his grandson or granddaughter that got married. I just watched this dude dance. It was incredible. His dance was so robust, it kind of just swallowed the whole hotel. Every eye was glued to this man because he was living out loud. He was dressed in black and white, but he was in full color, and he was at full throttle. Dancing before the Lord. And then something occurred to me. These are the descendants of Jesus' people. This is the land that produced the people who produced Jesus. Jesus is like these folks. He's not like the blue-blooded, halo-wearing, castle-dwelling Europeans in the medieval paintings. He's not like them. He's like this. We don't serve a God who's afraid to get on the floor. We don't serve a God who's afraid to get in it with us. We don't serve a God who's afraid to get a little oil on his shirt or a little honey on his mouth. We serve the Lord, mighty in battle, who swallows up the cosmos with his glory, who is the King of glory, the Lord. Verse 9, so open your doors. So open your doors that the King of glory may come in. The passage ends with an invitation to response. Yeah, he's playing Just as I Am. You got to choose to open the city gates. When you're an ancient city, you have to choose to open the city gates. And anytime you open the city gates, it's risky. Many times in antiquity, foes came in the guise of friends. And once the city gates were open, enemies attacked and burned cities and ravaged the population. You read about it over and over and over again. To open the gates is to make one vulnerable. It's an act of supreme trust. In our dangerous society today, it's like opening your front door. I don't know about you, but when somebody knocks on my door, I act like I didn't hear. Right? You know? I'm just sitting there thinking, I don't want to talk to them. I don't know what they want, but I don't want to talk to them. You know? It's an act of trust to open that door. Psalm 24 is the invitation to invite the King of glory into our lives. This is who he is. He is the Lord, mighty in battle. He's the King of kings. He's the Lord of lords. But are you going to open your door to God? Are you going to open the door? Nobody can do that for you. And yet to open the door is not only to ask God to enter, it's to ask God to dwell. A lot of times we want God to come by for a short visit, but we really don't want him to stay. And we can't wait till he leaves so we can do all the stuff we know he really wouldn't like. Reminds me of what I'm going to preach on Sunday, Revelation 3:20. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears the voice and open the door, I will come in and I will have supper with them. I will dwell with them and they with me. A lot of times we'd be happy to open the door and say, King of glory, are you just staying for a short time? But he wants to dwell in our lives. And if he dwells in our lives, he's going to eradicate all those things in our lives that aren't like him. He's going to expose darkness in our lives. He's going to challenge the way we think. He's going to challenge the core values we have. That's what happens when the King of glory comes in. And still he knocks. You turn off the TV. You hope he goes away. You go hide in the basement. And still he knocks. I purchased a hammer dulcimer from a dulcimer shop in the Smoky Mountains a few years ago. While I was waiting to check out, it occurred to me to ask a question. I asked the proprietor, how do you play it? He said, pick out your very favorite song and practice it every day and memorize it. Don't try to learn to read the music, just memorize the song. And he said, at first you're going to struggle. But he said, then it's going to sound a little bit like that song. And he said, if you practice it every day, one day you'll get it down. I said, how will I know if I get it down? He says, is it going to be your favorite song? I said, yes, sir. He said, you'll know you have it down when you cry. When you play the song and tears come to your eyes, you'll know you have it down. When that happens, you got it. Many of us have read this psalm many times, but I want to pray that this evening our hearts will be warmed and our emotions will be stirred. And like my friend James, I want to pray that we see the light. Let me close with the old King James version. King James is like strapping on a real pair of Chuck Taylor Converse tennis shoes. The earth is the Lord's, and the fullness thereof. the world and they that dwell within. For he hath founded it upon the seas and established it upon the floods. Who shall ascend into the hill of the Lord? Or who shall stand in his holy place? He that hath clean hands and a pure heart, who hath not lifted up his soul into vanity and not sworn deceitfully. He shall receive the blessing of the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. This is the generation of them that seek him, that seek thy face, O Jacob. Lift up your heads, ye mighty gates, and be ye lift up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in. Who is the King of glory? The Lord, strong and mighty. The Lord, mighty in battle. Lift up your heads, O ye gates. Even lift them up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in. Who is the King of glory? The Lord of hosts. He is the King of glory.